Good morning once again. Happy Sabbath. How many of you are fans of the original Star Trek series? I always enjoyed it. What do you call a set of eyeglasses on the planet Vulcan? Spoctacles, yeah. Right. How many ears does Captain Kirk have? Three, right? Left, right, and the final front ear. How many Klingons does it take to change a light bulb? None. Klingons are not afraid of the dark. Alternative is two. One to change it, the other one to stab the other one in the back and take all the credit. I try to find some jokes about Scotty. Of course, being a Scot, being an engineer, identified with that. My people are Scottish. And, of course, I was an engineer in a former life. But I couldn't find any good jokes for Scotty. But you probably remember his catchphrase, which was this. Captain, she cannot take much more abuse. Right? Captain was always wanting Scotty to push the ship to its limits. But Scotty, trying to protect the vessel and everyone there, said, she can't take much more abuse. How about you? How much abuse can you take? To one degree or another, we all suffer from abuse. Something that may have occurred to you as you begin to prepare for the Passover and the spring holy days, going through self-exam. Now, I'm not talking necessarily about physical abuse. Now, if you're in a relationship that is physically abusive, seek help, all right? Seek help to get out of that. For safety's sake, at least temporarily. If that's the situation you're in, please get help. And if that's something that you need help to do, please see me. But that's really not the subject of today's message. I'd like to talk about emotional abuse. Emotional abuse. I think it's something that we've probably all faced. Probably anybody from about age 5 and up, you've had to deal with emotional abuse one way or another. Our school systems are rampant with it. I'll give you an example. Two kids playing with a toy. One little tyke, 5 years old, says to the other, says, give me that toy, or I'm going to tell the teacher you're picking your nose. Well, the other kid says, well, wait, that's not true. I didn't do that. The accuser says, yeah, you did. I saw you do it in the bathroom. You give me the toy, I'm going to tell the teacher. The second little guy says, well, it wasn't me. Well, was it? Did I? Maybe I did. Yeah, it was. It was you. And if you don't give that to me, I'm going to tell the teacher, and you're going to go to the principal's office, and your parents are going to get a phone call. And what happens? Okay, just take the toy. Take the toy. Just please don't tell. I don't want to get in trouble. In the matter of a few words, one little guy abuses another with his own emotions. There's doubt. There's fear. There's shock. All these things used from one to get what they wanted from the other. So you might realize, well, considering that, emotional abuse is probably pretty rampant. But you know what else is perhaps even more shocking? We've all been guilty of being emotionally abusive to others. Every one of us, you, me, we've all done it one way or another. So that's what I'd like to talk about today. And more specifically, how to stop emotional abuse. Even if you're the one who's giving it, whether you're receiving or giving, it's something that we can look at and examine and consider and become more aware of in an effort to stop using others' emotions against them. Let's first start with a working definition of what emotional abuse is. Or actually, you know what? Let's start with what it's not. Looked at an article here. This is from www.psychologytoday. It's an article written by a gal named Andrea Matthews. It was written September 26, 2016. And she is a licensed professional counselor and a national certified counselor. What she says is this. She says, it is not emotionally abusive to argue or to have a disagreement. It is not emotionally abusive when someone reacts to what you have done with hurt. People react out of their own perception, so their reactions do not define your behavior. It's also not emotional abuse to speak one's mind with blunt honesty. Perhaps the statement lacks tact, but it's not emotionally abusive. Again, just because someone reacts to what has been said with hurt does not mean that one has been emotionally abused. So in other words, when someone says something to us that we don't want to hear, that just doesn't automatically qualify as emotional abuse. There's an excellent example of this in Acts 23. Let me begin turning there. In Acts 23, we read about the Apostle Paul going under house arrest. He's getting ready to stand trial before the governor, Felix. And give me a little backup here. We'll start in Acts 23. Verse 37. It'd be hard to start in 37 since there is no 37. 27, rather. And so Felix writes a letter. Claudius writes a letter to Felix and kind of gives him some background of what happened. Verse 27, he says, "This man, seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them. Coming with the troops, I rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman." So, you know, they understood Paul was a Roman citizen. There was something going on in amongst the Jews. The lieutenant governor, ruler of this area, Claudius, basically steps in to stop bloodshed from happening. He says, "And when I wanted to know the reason why they accused him, I brought him before their council. I found out that he was accused concerning questions of their law, but had nothing charged against him deserving a death or chains. When it was told me that the Jews lay in wait for the man, I sent him immediately to you and also commanded his accusers to state before you the charges against him. Farewell." So basically, there's this disturbance, and Claudius kind of punts to Felix and say, "Hey, this isn't really a matter of our law, but I'm sending it on up the line, on up the chain, just to make sure we get our bases covered here." Acts 24, then, we see Paul's accusers, Ananias and Tertullus, they make their accusations. Felix hears them, and basically at the end of it, we read Acts 24, picking up in verse 22. Felix, after kind of hearing opening arguments, you might say, he says, "But when Felix heard these things, having more accurate knowledge of the way," of course, well, how they describe early followers of Jesus Christ before they were called Christians, he said, "having more accurate knowledge of the way, he adjourned the proceedings and said, when Lysias the commander comes down, I will make a decision in your case. So he commanded the centurion to keep Paul and to let him have liberty, and told him not to forbid any of his friends to provide for or visit him." So basically, Paul goes under house arrest, and Felix says, "Okay, don't go nowhere. Let's just sit tight, put a lid on this, and we'll get this all sorted out." In the meantime, Felix wants to get to know a little bit more about Paul, and we'll see a little bit, some reasons in that later on, but let's pick it up in verse 24, continue in verse 24. He says this, "As after some days, when Felix came with his wife Drusilla, who was Jewish, he sent for Paul and heard him concerning the faith in Christ." So, Felix is getting to know Paul a little bit here, maybe just kind of wanting to get a little more background, know a little bit about his character. Of course, if you skip ahead in the story in verse 26, we see that, you know, Felix was open to the idea of receiving a bribe as well. But there's a little bit more to this story that we're not told here in Scripture. Looking at some of the other historical references, we can kind of fill in the blanks and kind of read between the lines. This is from the NIV Cultural Background Study Bible. It's an e-book published by HarperCollins. This is the same one I mentioned a couple weeks ago that Scott Ashley recommended. It's actually now available in a New King James Version, and it's available in hard copy as well. But these particular notes are from the NIV version, and it's from the e-book. But it has this to say about Felix. It says, "Over the years, Felix married three different princesses. The most lasting marriage was with Drusilla, the younger sister of Agrippa II and Bernice, whom Felix had married perhaps 4 years before this scene. When Drusilla was 16, Felix convinced her to divorce her husband to marry him, even though governors were not supposed to marry women from the provinces they administered. Officials were also not supposed to use prisoners for private ends, as here and in verse 26. And that's verse 26 is where it mentions him, you know, hoping to maybe receive a bribe from Paul or Paul's supporters. So there was a little bit of background going on here. Felix was on, you know, wife number three here. He was really not doing according to what was right in God's eyes, certainly. If you read more into the story, it seems that he lured Drusilla away from her husband, caused her to divorce him and come marry him. He was using her connections as being Jewish to kind of get a little more information from Paul, or perhaps trying to appease his wife, was using his powerful influence to make Paul come before him. So there's a few things going on there behind the scenes that says, you know, Felix is not quite on the up and up here. With that in mind, we can read on verse 25. So this is after he had called Paul before him to explain more about his beliefs and maybe, you know, hopefully get a little chummier with Paul so that he could get a few bucks out of him. He says, now as he reasoned about righteousness, this is speaking of Paul, now as he reasoned about righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come, Felix was afraid and answered, go away for now. When I have a convenient time, I will call for you. So Felix, having stolen another man's wife and trying to use Paul for his own personal gain, he probably didn't like too much about what Paul was saying when it came to being righteous, self-control, and there being judgment to come. Was Paul emotionally abusing Felix? No. Paul said, you know, there's right and there's wrong. And there's judgment for not doing that. If we don't watch ourselves, we will be found in the judgment seat. We will be found being judged if we're not able to judge ourselves. It talks about that later on. Matter of fact, let's go over to Galatians 1. Galatians 1. Galatians 6, verse 1. Galatians 6, verse 1, we receive a reminder as brothers and sisters in Christ. It says, brethren, if a man is overtaken in any trespass, you who are spiritual, restore such a one in a spirit of gentleness, considering yourself, lest you also be tempted. Now, if we see a brother or sister that's overtaken in trespass, in sin, you know, we are to talk to them in gentleness, in meekness, in kindness. Not jumping up and down at them saying, you know, you horrible person. But we are to talk. We are to speak to them. It's a reminder that when we're told things that maybe we don't want to hear by someone, that's not necessarily emotional abuse. There is right. There is wrong. And when we hear that, people aren't abusing us. That being said, what is emotional abuse? What is emotional abuse? Continuing from that article from Psychology Day, today, it says, emotional abuse is an attempt to control in just the same way that physical abuse is an attempt to control another person. The only difference is that the emotional abuser does not use physical hitting, kicking, pinching, grabbing, pushing, or other physical forms of harm. Rather, the perpetrator of emotional abuse uses emotion as his or her weapon of choice. So working definition then for emotional abuse might be using emotions to manipulate other people. Using emotions to manipulate other people. Let's look at another story from the Bible and kind of see how this plays out. You might remember, you can begin turning to 2 Samuel chapter 15. You might remember a few weeks ago we read the story about Absalom his stepbrother Amnon taking advantage of his sister Tamar. He goes, he kills, has Amnon killed. He is cast out of the kingdom. Eventually, he's allowed to come back, comes back into his father David's good graces. So we see Absalom, so shortly after that happens, and Absalom is back in town. 2 Samuel 15, verse 1. And let's notice emotion in this story. 2 Samuel 15, verse 1. It says, after this, it happened that Absalom provided himself with chariots and horses and 50 men to run before him. Now Absalom would rise early and stand beside the way of the gate. So it was whenever anyone who had a lawsuit came to the king for a decision that Absalom would call to him and say, what city are you from? And he would say, your servant is from such and such a tribe of Israel. So what's going on here? So he's hiring all these people to run before him. Basically, he's kind of trying to look like a pseudo king. You know, he hires 50 bodyguards to go in front of him. And basically, it's a way of tooting his own horn and saying, look at me, I'm important, you know, without saying those words directly. And then he hangs out where the elders of the town hang out at the gate, and he listens to people's problems, and he says, oh, you're from such and such a town? Love that town. Great town. What's going on in your life, you know? He's kind of schmoozing people up a little bit. Verse 3, he says, then Absalom will say to them, look, your case is good and right, but there is no deputy of the king to hear you. Moreover, Absalom would say, oh, that I were made judge in the land, and everyone who has any suit or cause would come to me, then I would give him justice. He's saying, boy, I sure wish I could do something about it, but, you know, just nothing I can do because I'm not king. But if I was, I'd help you out. Verse 5, he goes on. He says, and so it was whenever anyone came near to bow down to him that he would put out his hand and take him and kiss him. So, you know, he wasn't king, so he really couldn't let people bow to him because that may actually catch the notice of the king's guard. So instead, he just kind of lets him kiss his ring, so to speak. You know, he's basically shaking hands and kissing babies, you know, playing politics at this point in time to get the popular vote. Verse 6, it says, in this manner, Absalom acted toward all Israel who came to the king for judgment. So Absalom stole the hearts of the men of Israel. Absalom plays the emotion card to get the hearts, to get the love of all those in Israel, to get their support, to get their backing. Ultimately, you know, he does this to overthrow his father. Of course, you know the story. There is a temporary schism there where Absalom takes control for a while. There's several skirmishes, battles. Absalom ultimately winds up losing his life along with, you know, many others during those battles. But we see where Absalom uses people's emotions against them. He starts kind of, you know, playing on their feelings. Oh, you've got a good case there. Wow. Sure wish I could help you. You know, and he starts planting seeds. And eventually, he gets what he wants. We've seen a couple examples then of what is and what is not emotional abuse in the Bible. So clearly, in order for emotional abuse to be abuse, there has to be an abusive element. Paul was not abusing Felix, right? Absalom did abuse the people. Going back to the example of those two kids, imagine for a minute that the kid who, you know, accused the other kid of picking his nose or whatever, instead of doing that, he says, hey, you know, you've been playing with that toy for quite a while. Why don't you take a turn and you know, why don't you share it, let everybody else play with it a little bit? Now, is that emotionally abusive? No, it's not. It's using logic, it's using reason, and it's appealing to someone's sense of fairness and sharing. So, in order for something to be emotionally abusive, it has to be truly abusive. It's not talking to someone about doing the right thing. So let's now turn our attention to the matter of being able to stop emotional abuse. Now, I'm not a psychologist, I'm not a therapist, I'm not a licensed counselor. But I think we can see from a few biblical principles here some tips that we can put into place to help break that cycle. Let's look at some examples of how it might play out in our lives, whether we find ourselves being victims or whether we find ourselves being perpetrators. Emotional abuse in our lives might sound something like this. If you love me, you'd fill in the blank. You know, let me spend $5,000 on season tickets to whatever team I want. Spend, you know, $1,500 on a new diamond ring I can't really afford. You know, let me spend $5,000 on the wheels for my car, which doesn't even run. You know, some sort of thing where we say, if then. It puts pressure. Well, what's this do? For the person being abused, it puts the pressure on them. The abuser takes and starts using the abused person's emotions against them, puts pressure on them. They doubt their love for me. I love them. Well, I guess I can afford that. Maybe if I have to. Now, occasionally, this might backfire on the abuser. And the person being abused says, yep, guess I don't love you. And they walk away. Now, that's not really the desired outcome, necessarily. But it kind of points us towards a solution. One of the key things and stopping emotional abuse is don't let people abuse you. Don't let people abuse you. Let's go to Daniel chapter 3. See an example here. Daniel chapter 3, you know the story. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were getting ready to face the fiery furnace. Now, this would very quickly go from emotional to physical abuse, but notice it does start with an emotional sort of a tone to it. Let's pick the story up in verse 15. It says, now, if you are ready at the time you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the harp, the lyre, and the psaltery, and symphony with all kinds of music, and you fall down and worship the image which I have made, good. But if you do not worship, you shall be cast immediately in the midst of the burning fiery furnace. Okay, so you know the backstory, of course. There's this image. When the music played, everyone was supposed to bow down and worship it. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego refused to. So it finally gets called before to the king, you know, person to person, face to face. And what's he say? If you do this, good. If you do what I want you to do, good, I like you. But if you don't, bad things are going to happen. So he's using the emotions there of approval and fear. Of course, you know what happened. It says, continuing on, it says, and who is the God who will deliver you from my hands? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. What's the first thing they do? They basically disarm his argument. He says, if that's the case, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we do not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image that you have set up. See, Nebuchadnezzar tries to set up an if-then statement. You know, if you're good people, you'll do what I say. And if not, then the converse is true. You're bad. He tries to use the emotions of approval and fear to get them to do it. Their reaction, though, is to not accept that statement. They don't accept that, well, if A is true, then B is true. They say, you know, that's not really the only two possible outcomes, King. They said there's another possible outcome, and that is that God will save us. And, oh, by the way, even if he does it, we're still not doing it. They reject the emotional abuse. See, that's what we do when we set up an A-B argument, what's often referred to as an A-B argument. It's like saying, well, if it's raining outside, then that car must be blue. Well, the two things aren't even related. Whether it's raining or not, that car is blue. It doesn't have anything to do with it. But that's what we do when we emotionally abuse people. We try to set them up to say, if you love me, if you approve me, if you want my approval, you'll do this. Another example, one that isn't quite as nonsensical about the raining and what color the car is dealing with somebody maybe who's had too much to drink. Telling them, you know, I don't think you should drive home. Their answer might be something like, oh, I'm fine. I don't need your help. You're always telling me what to do. You think you're so much better than I am. So if you tell me that I shouldn't drive, you must think that you're better than I am. And I know you're not perfect. I know you're a sinner. I know you're a hypocrite. Well, any of us here without sin? No. We might have sin. That might be true. But does that mean it's okay for that person to get in the car and drive? It doesn't. It doesn't. You know, people try to use emotions against one another all the time. And it starts with a false premise. It just starts on some level with that if-then. If you do this, if you don't do this, then you must be this or you must be that. This is where we can start to break the cycle of emotional abuse, is to reject that argument. It's not something Christ said over in Matthew 6, verse 16. Matthew 6, verse 16. Matthew 6, verse 16. Christ says this, it says, moreover, when you fast, do not be like the hypocrites with a sad countenance, for they disfigure their faces that they may appear to men to be fasting. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward. Now here Christ is talking about people sort of faking, you know, what they look like when they're in discomfort from fasting, saying, oh, this is so tough. Oh, I'm so much pain, but I got to do it. I got to do it because I know that's what God wants me to do. I need to be fasting to get close to God. Those are true statements. But those are not things that we go around proclaiming and sharing with others to let them know how righteous we are. See, that's what happens. Someone who's being emotionally abusive is trying to change the argument, trying to take the focus off of whatever their real problem might be. The alcoholic who says, oh, you know, I can drive home, he's trying to change the focus. Put the argument back on the other person saying, oh, well, you know what? You're not without fault. You know, that may be true, but it doesn't change the problem. It doesn't change the fact that they shouldn't be driving. Christ is pointing out with those who are being hypocritical and they're fasting, saying, yeah, you know, you need to fast. That's what you need to do. But you know what? It's not about what other people think of you. It's about you dealing with your problems, about you getting close to God so you can understand what it is you need to do, you need to change. He says when people do that, they get what they want. They get the attention. They get the glory from everybody else thinking, wow, that person's so devout. Look how humble they are. I said that they're getting what they want now, but you know, in the long run, it's not going to pay off because they haven't dealt with the real issue. What it takes in order to break the cycle of emotional abuse is to take emotion off the table. Take emotion off the table. So Christ says, so don't pay attention to their disfigured faces. Don't pay attention to their cry for attention. He said, that's not reality. That's what people are saying, what people are throwing out there just to try to get what they want. The reality isn't that I don't love you because I couldn't buy you season tickets. People use that emotion to try to manipulate. So we have to take the emotion out of the situation. Think about it for this for a moment. Seems to be the theme this week with all the basketball upsets going on. What happens if the other team starts to run up the score on you? What do you do? Take the ball out of their hands. You clamp down on defense. You slow the game down. You don't let them play the run and gun or whatever it is that's running up the score. Don't give them the tool that they need to win. In emotional abuse, it's much the same way. We have to take our emotions off the table. At least temporarily. At least temporarily. You might tell the abuser, listen, you know, I might not be perfect. I wish I had more money to spend on you. Whatever it might be. But the reason I can't do that is because we simply can't afford it. Or the reason I don't want you to get in that car and drive is because I don't want you to get hurt. I don't want to see anybody get hurt. It's going to have to appeal to a little bit of logic and reason. Now, I'm not saying that when you do this, everything will just be hunky-dory and an immediate change in response on those trying to abuse you. You know, in the example of the drunk, they might change tactics a little bit. They might go from making you feel guilty to about, you know, being hypocritical to saying, oh, well, what difference does it make? If I get in the car, I die, you wouldn't care anyway. So they might switch tactics a little bit. It's going to require firmness. It's going to require standing pat and saying, no, what's right is right. What's wrong is wrong. I would care if something happened to you, but it's not okay for you to get in that car. This might go on for a while. It might be difficult, but it's how we can begin to start to break this cycle if we find ourselves victims of abuse. Now understand a couple of things. This isn't a end-all be-all to stopping the cycle of this abuse. But it's a process. It's where we can start. It's where we can start to look at how we're being taken advantage of and get help. The person who's trying to abuse you, they may not stop right away. But if you can step back for a moment and not let yourself be manipulated, hopefully you can come to the point where you can have a rational, reasonable conversation. And if not, then at least you've stopped yourself from being abused. The other thing to be said is this. It's easy to check your emotions. I shouldn't say it's easy. It's possible to check your emotions at the door for a few minutes. But you can't get away from them forever. There's things there that you're going to have to talk about, that you're going to have to deal with. You may be able to put them aside. You may need to put them aside for a few moments just to break that cycle. But at some point in time, you might find you need to talk to someone. You might need to share your emotions with a trusted loved one, someone who's not going to try to abuse you with your own emotions. It might be a friend. It might be a counselor. On some level, it should be God. Those emotions, though, are in us, and they need to be dealt with. They need to come out. So keep those two things in mind, that we won't instantaneously stop the cycle, but we can begin to break the chain, and that emotions still need to be dealt with. I'm not saying that we shouldn't have emotions, only that at times we may need to take them out of the situation for a moment or two. So let's get then to the last question, really the most difficult question of the day. How do I stop abusing others? How do I stop abusing others? It's appropriate that we're at the time of year where we're doing a deep personal evaluation of ourselves, a self-examination, as we read about 1 Corinthians 11 a couple weeks ago. It's going to require an honest introspective. Our role as emotional abuser, we almost always think we're right. Well, she cared about my happiness. She let me spend, you know, $1,500 on wheels and tires for a car that doesn't even run, or whatever it might be. See how silly that sounds when you actually say it out loud? When we say some of the things that we want? But, you know, I want that. It's what I want. That's my little baby. That's my pet project. To me, it makes all the sense in the world. So again, we have to stop. We have to step back and take our own emotions out of things We have to go back past what we want, past even what someone else wants, past emotion, past logic for that matter, and take it all the way back to what God wants. To look at us, look at the situation, see things how God sees us. It's going to have to start with a prayer like what David had in Psalm 19. Psalm 19. Psalm 19, we'll pick it up in verse 7. It says, "The law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The statutes of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes." Now, God's laws are what is right. Not the things that I've come up with. Not my feelings, not my emotions, not my wants. Take it all the way back to step number one. God defines what's right, what's wrong. One of the things that we all are very, very good at is justifying what we want. My first engineering co-op as a young man worked with a group of guys, and one was kind of the sage old veteran. He was the very stereotypical engineer. He had the thick black glasses. He had the pocket protector, the scale in his pocket. You know, wore a button-up short sleeve shirt with a skinny black tie. You know, kind of what you would picture an engineer from the 60s. This was the mid-90s, and he was near retirement. But he had passed on several things to the younger guys. And by the time I got there, those guys were starting to pass things on to me. One of the things he said is, "Dan, you can justify anything you want. Whatever it is you want." Now, of course, in engineering, we were talking about a design. You know, maybe sometimes there was a problem, and one person would come up with a solution with one design, and another person would come up with a solution to another design. And if I came up with this one, I really liked mine, even though you could look at the two on paper and see that the other guy's was actually a lot better. It was simpler, it was more robust, it cost less money. But I like mine because it's cool, and I came up with it, and I like it. I can justify doing whatever I want. And, of course, he conveyed that beyond engineering, human nature was much the same way. You can justify anything you want. Some of the most true words I think I've ever heard, and I hearken back to those often. Verse 12 here in Psalm 19 continues on. Says, "Who can understand his errors? Cleanse me from secret faults. Keep back your servant also from presumptuous sins. Let them not have dominion over me. Then I shall be blameless, and I shall be innocent of great transgression." What happens when we get that presumptuous sin? I really want those wheels. I gotta have them. It has dominion over us. It becomes our God. Says here, "Cleanse me from my secret faults." Who are these faults secret from? Well, it ain't God. He knows. And you know what? Good chance that somebody you're close to probably understands those faults as well. You know, sometimes our faults are most secret to us. They're most secret to us. Told Jeremiah 17:9, "Heart is deceitful above all things. The heart wants what the heart wants." You've heard it said in many different ways. Luke 6:45 tells us, says, "It's out of the abundance of the heart the mouth speaks." What our feelings really are, deep down inside, you know, that's eventually what comes to the surface. Other people see that. Other people see our motivations. We need to examine ourselves and ask God, "Why am I doing the things I'm doing?" We need to humbly ask that. We need to remember the words, Proverbs 3, verse 30. Proverbs 3, verse 30 says, "Do not strive with a man without cause if he has done you no harm." Is someone telling me I can't have what I want harmful to me? No. I mean, it might hurt my feelings. Someone's telling us something that's not harmful to us. You know what? Maybe we should listen. Maybe we should listen. It's not our first reaction. Our first reaction is to justify, to become defensive, and say, yeah, but, whatever. If someone's done us no harm, maybe it's time we listen. Let's go back to Psalm again, Psalm 32. Psalm 32. Thinking about justification. Psalm 32, verse 1, he says, "Blessed is he whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. Blessed is the man to whom the Lord does not impute iniquity, and in whose spirit there is no deceit." Isn't that what justification really is? We're kidding ourselves. We're deceiving ourselves. Whatever we want is okay. Verse 3 says, "When I kept silent, my bones grew old through my groaning all day long. For day and night your hand was heavy upon me. My vitality was turned into the drought of summer." You may remember the hymn we sing often. You know, "Day and night God's hand was on me, and I groaned till I confessed." You know, we think about that, and we think, when we truly are submissive, when we truly go to God and we say, "Show me my faults," it's going to hurt. It's going to hurt. But there's going to become a cleansing. There's going to come a cleansing, and we do this because we want that iniquity removed from us, because otherwise we are guilty. Verse 5, he says, "I acknowledge my sin to you, and my iniquity I have not hidden. I said I will confess my transgression to the Lord, and you forgave the iniquity of my sin." Isn't that what we want? Isn't that what next week pictures as we come to the Passover? Isn't that what the days of unleavened represent? Putting sin out of our lives. When we have a problem, the guilt remains. But when we go to God and we say, "You know, I've got this problem, show it to me so that the guilt from my sin can be taken away," then we, as abusers, can begin to break that cycle. Emotional abuse is rampant in our world. Just because somebody tells us something we don't want to hear doesn't mean we're being emotionally abused. When people try to use emotion to manipulate others to get what it is they want, not to show what's right and wrong, that's emotional abuse. It's been around forever. The Bible's full of accounts of it. But we can begin to break the cycle if we can at least temporarily pull in our emotions and don't allow ourselves to be pulled or put into impossible arguments. Those arguments won't be resolved in an instant. But what we can begin to do is to break the cycle of abuse. Likewise, if we find ourselves guilty of abusing others, we need to be honest. We're going to have to be honest with ourselves and with God to see if indeed we are guilty of that. It starts with prayer, asking God to show us who we are, what we are. Asking him, "Let me see me as you see me," requires a submissive act of listening to God and to others and giving up our justifications on what it is we want. We may never end all the emotional abuse out there in the world, but if we take a few steps and we be honest with each other, we can begin to break that chain, that cycle of emotional abuse. As we head into the Passover, let each one examine ourselves and let us all do our part in ending the abuse of emotion.